Peace and welcome back to For the Culture right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM and WEAA.org. Absolutely, the voice of the community. I'm your host, Faraji Muhammad. Thank you so much for checking in and riding with me for the second hour of tonight's show, folks. I just want to get a few last calls as we've been talking about the latest developments in the Jeffrey Epstein case, as he has been charged with allegedly running a sex trafficking ring. And we're going to be talking to Kevin and Abraham in a few moments out of Baltimore. Also this hour, we're going to talk to representatives from Amnesty International. They're going to talk about this ongoing push for survivors of gun violence to receive some level of reparations. They're going to define what that means and what does that look like, especially in the cities such as Baltimore and other cities that are plagued by gun violence. So we'll have that conversation in a few moments. But let's get back to the phone lines and hear what folks have to say. Kevin, checking in from Baltimore, what's your take on this Jeffrey Epstein case?
Well, I got a few things to say.
Yes, sir.
Raj, I think that, first of all, I'd like to say pardon. I would hope a lot of people know what a pardon is, a presidential pardon.
Oh, you think that's the direction that this is going to go in?
Yeah, so it doesn't matter because you got a lot of players in that game right there, you know?
Yeah.
That's a worldwide game. It's just not here in America.
Right.
Number two, I think a lot of people are naive, and I'll go back to what you were saying before you went to break, you know, the way the world works, you know, money, power, and influence, and relationships, let me ask you this. At what time in mankind has the government ever been for the people?
Mm.
There's never been a time, ever, I don't care what country in the world, that the government, the kings and queens, the hierarchy or whatever, has ever been there for the people. I don't care what they say they are. JFK said, don't ask what the country can do for you, ask what you can do for the country.
You know?
I mean, they put it right there, out there in our face, yet we still choose to believe, you know, this facade of fantasy that, you know, that doesn't exist. You know what I mean? I think that when people show you and tell you who they are and what it is, then you should believe them. If you got money, power, and influence in those type of relationships, where there's two different there's two different legal systems here, especially here in America. There's two different legal systems. There's one for regular folks, and then there's one for those folks.
Those folks. Hey, Kevin, thank you so much for checking in. Presidential pardon. Did not think about that one. That would be interesting. That certainly would be an interesting turn of events. Abraham, what's your take on it? Checking in from East Baltimore.
Well, I'd like to say thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome, Abraham.
No, I agree with the caller just before me. No. Have you ever heard of a mental health court system?
Mental health court system?
Yes, that means it's a plea that if you're in a kind of a state of mind, you can enter a plea of going into a mental health court system.
So it sounds like it's beyond the plea of insanity.
That's right. You're right about that.
Okay.
And this is a politics coming up, election season coming up. There's people standing in line for jobs, so it's going to help this man get a mental health system court deal. There's no doubt about it. And all I got to say, I've been in a situation like that where they try to offer me a mental health system court deal, and I said, refuse it. I know what was going to happen. There's no way I was going to get out of the situation. That means I have to go in front of a judge if in case I get into trouble. It's just like being in front of a parole and probation officer.
Yeah.
So he's going to get off scot-free. Y'all might think he's going to serve some time. Yes, they're going to tell the public that.
Yeah.
But he is going to get a senti plea deal.
Mm.
And have a nice day.
Hey, Abraham, thank you so much for checking in from East Baltimore. Many folks do not believe that this is going to lead to any level of justice. Dwayne, you got the final word. What's your take?
I agree with the two justice systems, one for the rich and one for the not so rich. But the point I want to make is that, you know, the underground people are very naive, as that caller once said, not only to politics, not only to power and the dynamics of power and how much power actually controls everything, but people are totally naive to the underground sex world. It's happening all around us, and it's been going on since man came to the shores of America.
You think people are naive, or we just don't really want to talk about it because it's such a disturbing crime? I can't believe that people are naive. You know, in 2019, we're naive about people exploiting children for sexual benefit. Really?
Well, when I say naive, I partly mean, you know, people are naive to the enormity of it.
Oh, okay.
People are naive, you know, in the sense of, like, you when you think about what this guy's being accused of, you're like, damn, for real?
right. You okay. I see what you're saying. Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
See how far-reaching it can be.
Exactly. And this stuff's been going on forever. This is not anything new. But when you're rich and powerful and you have all the shiny accoutrement of being rich and powerful, you got to get your rocks off somehow. So, of course, you're going to go and set up your own, you know, I mean, money can, it can, like you said before, money can corrupt you. It can turn you dark.
Yeah. But you know what? Is it money, or is that, you know, sometimes that's the character. If that's the character of an individual and then they have access to money and to resources, I mean, it's not the money fault as much as the character of the individual. And of course, you understand that because we always talk about character here on this
Absolutely.
Show. And I agree with you. I think that many people don't talk about it, don't want to believe that somebody can think so satanically. You know what I mean? I think that's the bigger part of it. Like, when we talk about certain cases, even when we talked about R. Kelly, when we talked about Bill Cosby, we don't want to actually believe that somebody can think so wicked to try to take advantage of children or take advantage of individuals or victimize people. I mean, we don't want to believe that, because I think many of us, we try to believe in the quote-unquote the goodness of every human being. We try to look beyond color. But we don't want to truly believe that there are some people that have some very, very wicked hearts, wicked souls that exist in this world today.
Absolutely. And that's why I said a couple of weeks ago on your show that we hyper-idealize people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We think that everybody's good and everybody's going to do good, you know. And that, you know, sets up a situation like what we have. Our shock that these human beings, you know, are running this sex ring, you know, these rich and powerful people. I mean, it's crazy.
That's absolutely crazy. Hey, Dwayne, I always appreciate you. Thank you so much for checking in, brother. Good to talk to you. Look, folks, all I'm going to say is that we're going to keep our eyes on this whole case. I'm going to be interested. It's going to be interesting to see if the victims that Ms. Julie Brown, the investigative journalist for the Miami Herald, if any one of those victims are going to come on out, not just one by one, but if there's going to be a chorus of victims that are going to start coming out to really emphasize the hurt, the pain that Mr. Epstein may have caused them while they were little girls. It's going to be interesting to see if the Democrats and the Republicans can set aside their partisans, and their partisans' way, excuse me, and to focus on justice for the victims. It's going to be interesting to see how President Trump handles one of his cabinet members being involved in this case. There are so many pieces and moving parts and uncertainties. it's going to be something that we have to keep our eyes on. But at the end of the day, this is unfortunately where we find ourselves in some level of leadership and power. We just have to be informed. And most importantly, we have to know that this actually is happening. This certainly does exist. And that we always have to fight for right in cases where things have gone wrong. Look, I got to take a quick pause. When we come back, we'll talk to folks out of Amnesty International. They're going to talk to us a little bit about survivors of gun violence in the United States. They have just released a report called Scars of Survival, Gun Violence and Barriers to Reparations in the USA. We're going to talk to them about this and certainly open up the phone lines to give you a chance to comment as well. Stay riding with us. There's a whole lot is coming up in the next few minutes of For the Culture here on WEAA. Welcome back to For the Culture here on WEAA 88.9 FM and WEAA.org. Folks, we want to switch gears a little bit as we talk to some folks out of Amnesty International to talk about their new report that is going to be released called Scars of Survival, Gun Violence and Barriers to Reparations in the United States of America. Joining us for this conversation, we have two folks, two individuals, Ernest Covington, who serves as the campaign manager for End Gun Violence for the Amnesty International, and Sanjita Ambist, who serves as an economic and social rights researcher as she worked on part of putting this report together. Ernest, Sanjita, thank you so much for being on For the Culture here on WEAA.
Hey, what's going on, bro? How are you?
Good. Sanjita?
Thank you so much. Yeah, we're really looking forward to this conversation.
Absolutely. Let's talk first about this report, because this was a report that Amnesty International facilitated and conducted back in 2018, if I'm not mistaken, based on the research that we have. And Amnesty did its work in looking into very different cities. You interviewed 25 gunshot survivors in cities such as Miami, Tampa, New Orleans, and Baltimore, all cities with high rates of gun violence. And you also spoke to caregivers, health workers, and public health experts, activists, advocates, and social workers looking at the impact of gun violence on survivors and victims. But you're also looking at how the fact that in this country, we are still light years behind, quote unquote, and making sure that some survivors of gun violence are really being taken care of by the United States government, that Amnesty International has called gun violence in America a human rights crisis. It's not a public health issue. It's a human rights crisis. Kenya Sanjita, I'm going to go to you first, and then Ernest, I want to get your take. Can you give us some insight about this as to why this report now, and why did Amnesty International decide to go in this direction to continue to beat the drums against gun violence?
Absolutely. So this report is a part of Amnesty International's broader campaign to end gun violence. And as you mentioned, it focused specifically on the experience of gunshot survivors. The reason we were very keen to highlight the huge gap in protection for survivors is that the U.S. government has a human rights obligation to ensure that gunshot survivors have access to effective remedies, including reparation. And reparation specifically includes compensation, it includes rehabilitation, that includes things like medical and psychological care, compensation for economically accessible harms, and these are exactly the sort of gaps or challenges that the survivors we spoke to were struggling with,
mm-hmm.
and the reason we felt it was so important to highlight the U.S. government's obligation to this end.
So, you know, are you finding, first and foremost, let's define reparations, because now we're in a very hyper-political landscape, Ernest. And when we talk about reparations now, It's been talked about in the context of, repairing the damage that have been done to black people in this country as from the experience of the transatlantic slave trade. But when you're saying reparations to repair the damage for gunshot survivors, how do we make sure that those conversations don't get so twisted up that people will say, well, no, we don't need that. We need reparations from slavery, not for guns.
I mean, I think you're right. But I mean, I think it goes hand in hand to a certain extent because, you know, if individuals, and especially in our community, black and brown community, that are already suffering from the transatlantic slave times and through civil rights time, through Reconstruction, et cetera, and all of that was never fixed. So many of those issues and challenges now is some of the root causes of why we have gun violence in some of our communities anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're going to start to repair in any form of fashion, we have to, this is an area to start doing and providing those reparations. And I know, you know, when folks hear reparations, they automatically think a check.
Right, exactly.
And so, you know, in the report that will be released, officially released on tomorrow, you'll see that reparations is a broader title that includes, as my colleague was saying, you know, it includes, you know, mental health services. It includes, you know, the physical therapy that individuals may need for lifelong quality of life. You know, many times in a shooting, we look at individuals that pass away from a gunshot wound.
Mm.
But we, you know, the conversation is never brought up about those survivors that now life has totally changed for them. They were set to go to school on scholarship, but then turn around and now aren't even able to walk anymore. But they still got a life to live. And so how do they now do that? How does the government that has failed them in protecting them from gun violence and not pass sustainable laws that will protect them from gun violence, how do the government, state and federally, now come back to aid them in view of reparations? And like I say, so that could be physical therapy, mental therapy, as well as some financial contributions because, you know, they've been out of work. They have now hospital bills that we all know the challenges in our healthcare system that aren't covering the total amount of a bill that they have now from emergency room to now everyday care. So that's where the reparations piece comes into play.
So reparation is not giving a survivor a flat check to say, here's $10,000 for your pain. No, I'm just serious. People tend to believe that it is. Like, here's $10,000. You got shot. Here's $10,000. Sanhita, to break it down for us and give us some insight into the actual costs and the numbers when you're talking about for what the, what a survivor of gun violence has to, that is incurred upon a survivor of gun violence. How much money are we talking here?
So that's a really difficult question, only because the costs would depend completely on the survivor, their circumstances, and their specific injury.
Okay.
But I could give an indication of an average from a study that we didn't do, but that we have heavily cited.
Okay.
That that talked about how much it would cost to treat a gunshot survivor who comes into hospital with an injury, and that is around. I'm just looking for the. Yeah, it's almost $95,000.
My goodness, $95,000 for one victim?
But this is an average. And
that's an average.
That's an average. So for some people, it could be much higher. In fact, some of the people we spoke to, their bills were much higher, especially because that sort of figure, I'm just looking for the exact figure as I talk to you, but that figure only covers emergency healthcare. It doesn't really talk about other types of healthcare that you would probably need over a lifetime.
Right.
And then what you are going to end up paying depends completely on your personal circumstances and whether you're insured or whether you're on Medicaid, whether you have access to other forms of financial support for your care.
Mm-hmm.
And for many people, these sort of expenses, even if it's not as high or sometimes when it's higher, can be debilitating and can make it very, very difficult to get back to life after something as traumatic as being shot in the first place.
Right, right. But if we're talking about $95,000, first of all, give me some context, Anhita, if you can. Is this based upon the city that you're in, since you know, Amnesty has done research in various cities, or is this like across the board on a national level?
So this particular figure is not based on research that we did.
Okay.
It's based on a research done by Johns Hopkins University in 2017.
Gotcha.
And the figures that they found, and these were national averages, were around $95,000. For people who've been hospitalized in the emergency department, and around $5,000 on average for people who've just come into the emergency department and need to be treated for a gunshot wound.
Right.
And again, these are averages. So depending on people's injuries, this could be much higher. And in our report tomorrow, we do document cases of people whose medical bills have actually been much higher than this. And even though they've had some support from insurance or Medicaid to pay off parts of it,
yeah,
they were still left with exorbitant residual costs, and that has had a huge impact on their lives.
So you're essentially saying, Sanhita, that a person who survives gunshot violence, they have to work through surviving that experience, and then they get a bill in the mail, and they're kind of re-victimized all over again because they have they're placed into a financial trouble in a place that they can't really get climbed themselves out of. They're owing hospitals and their insurance thousands of dollars. So they're getting victimized, quote unquote, twice.
In fact, we would say that it's even harder than that, because one of the only sources of support that survivors of crime have in the U.S. is the Victim Compensation Fund. And our report also looks into how the Victim Compensation Fund works for survivors of violence, and very often, particularly gun violence. And very often that process is not easy and is not adequate. So there are multiple challenges and barriers that survivors face once they've been shot just to get back.
Yeah. Look, folks, Ernest, I know that as we get deeper in this conversation, folks, I want to open up the phone lines, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. I want to share, get your comments and your thoughts about this, as Amnesty International has just, they're about to release a report around this issue of giving reparations to gunshot victims and survivors. They're talking about how the United States of America is failing to meet its human rights obligations to regulate the possession and use of firearms to really help those who have been victimized. This report, Scars of Survival, Gun Violence and Barriers to Reparation in the United States of America, will be coming out tomorrow to give us some insight as to the landscape of gun violence, the cost of it, the impact of it, and how government has been responding to it. Ernest, I want you to put it out there, because Amnesty International will actually be on campus tomorrow. Is that correct?
Yes. Tomorrow, 11 till 2, we will be releasing the report.
Yes.
And then having some roundtable conversation on deciding those, or working with the community, as Baltimore is one of the cities that we did the research in, coming up with the remedies, or at least starting the process of coming up with the remedies on how do we fix, quote-unquote, fix this problem and challenge the government, both the states and the federal government, on how to really support these victims of gun violence.
I want to take a quick pause. When we come back, we're going to start taking some folks' calls and also get some posts from and comments from our Facebook page. But, folks, I think this is a conversation that needs to be had. I want to delve into the fact that there's supposed to be a fund for victims. I wonder what that looks like here in Baltimore City. So we'll continue the conversation with Sanhita Ambest and Ernest Coverson about this issue of gun violence and reparations. We want you to join us at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Stay riding with me. A whole lot is coming up in the final 30 of For the Culture, right here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, absolutely the voice of the community. We'll be right back. I do this for my culture. Peace and welcome back to For the Culture right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM and WEAA.org. Absolutely the voice of the community. I'm your host, Faraji Muhammad. Thank you so much for checking in and riding with me. Folks, we have been talking to two guests from Amnesty International. We have been talking to Ernest Coverson, who serves as the campaign manager for End Gun Violence, and Sanjita Ambist, who is the economic and social rights researcher for Amnesty International. We've been having a conversation about gun violence victims and survivors, and how they need to be supported and how they need to get access to great health care, and essentially how they should get reparations. Now, these aren't just the normal reparations that we've been talking about in the slavery of what's been happening to black people in this country. But we're finding, according to their latest report, Scars of Survival, Gun Violence and Barriers to Reparations in the USA, they're finding, Amnesty International is seeing, that a lot of victims are not getting adequate health care. A lot of victims are not getting the needed support, the rehabilitation, or the compensation that are essential to ensure that the government fulfills its obligations to provide them with full and effective reparations. Now, as we have this conversation, again, I want you to join us, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, because Amnesty International will be having a free roundtable tomorrow here at Morgan State University to discuss this issue, to continue to speak out for the victims of violence. And you can learn more about this issue. You can learn about what Amnesty International is saying about the United States government, as it says that it's continuing to meet, to fail to meet its obligations, its human right obligations, by not adequately regulating the purchase, the possession, and the use of firearms. It's not meeting the obligations of making sure that victims of gun violence are supported. So there are so many different pieces to this conversation that I want you to be a part of. 410-319-8888. Sanjita, I want to go back to you very quickly, and then Ernest, I want to get some thoughts from you about this. How do you determine eligibility in a case like this? Because in Baltimore, the gun violence, we have unfortunately have experienced high levels of gun violence. We've had over 300 murders consistently, for at least for the past 5 years. But how do you determine, or from a government side, from a human rights side, how does it determine, like, you know what, this person should get some level of compensation or reparations versus this level? Is it based upon that? Like, okay, who is the actual victim? Because it could be a back and forth thing. So how was that determined, Sanjita?
Can you hear me?
Yep. Yeah,
perfect. So the main source for compensation at this point in time is state-level victim compensation programs, and that's one of the things that the report is looking a lot at. And each state-level victim compensation program has its own eligibility requirements. So the one in Maryland, which serves Baltimore, has quite a detailed list of requirements. And many of these requirements, we feel as Amnesty, are quite problematic and often end up excluding people who should be most deserving of compensation. Mm. So the report actually goes into a fair bit of detail about what these eligibility requirements should be like and where they need to be amended, where they need to be strengthened to ensure that people in communities that should be protected mm-hmm. are protected and not excluded from these funds. I can, just on the question of healthcare, for example, I think for us, we would say that all people should have access to quality healthcare, whatever the circumstances of their injury are. And that is an incredibly important recommendation from our point of view, to make sure that anybody who's injured is able to access affordable healthcare for as long as they need it. But the more detailed recommendations and ideas about what the eligibility criteria for victim compensation programs look like is definitely one of the things that we've gone into a fair bit of detail in the report.
So that access to healthcare, because one of the other things that you guys are saying is that if a person who may live in a low-income community and they become a victim of gun violence, and they go to try to, I mean, sometimes folks are covered. They may have insurance. They may not have insurance. If they do have insurance, they might have limited resources on that with that insurance plan. And also showing that in 2017 that a lot of folks aren't getting covered because the most common reason being the denying or closing a victim compensation application is being incomplete information. That a lot of folks are saying, look, they want your birth certificate. They want your Social Security card. They want all of your check stubs if you're working. This really becomes a very bureaucratic process when a person may have gone through a life-changing circumstance of being shot.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that we do point out a lot in the report about how there are bureaucratic challenges associated both in terms of accessing health care,
yes,
whether it's through your insurance or whether it's through Medicaid on the one hand, and in, like, accessing the victim compensation application. And as you rightly said, an incomplete application is one of the most common reasons why applicants are denied, just pointing to that huge bureaucratic hurdle, particularly at such a difficult time.
Right, right. Ernest, what's your take on this as well as we talk about this this campaign? You know, in Baltimore and a lot of other cities that have a lot of communities that are plagued by this issue, how can people find some level of justice given the fact of the bureaucracy and the history of gunshot victims not really being advocated for?
Yeah, I mean, and that's part of the conversation tomorrow, is trying to figure out how do we get folks in it, because as we see, you know, if you are poor in this country, you already have challenges dealing with systems within the country or within your city, within your municipality. And now if you're a victim of gunshot, all of that is amplified now. Those same challenges that you had of having, you know, your birth certificate and et cetera,
mm-hmm,
is now amplified. And, you know, it's so in with this report, one, we're hoping to bring light to that, because as well, many people don't even know there is this victim crimes fund that they can even apply for.
And who manages that fund, Ernest?
It's managed state by state.
Okay.
Each state manages it, and it's funded, if I'm correct, it's funded both through the state and through the federal, partially through the state and partially through the federal government.
Yeah.
But the state, each individual state sets their requirements, rules, and regulations, and decides who, you know, how much they're going to give each individual applicant.
But which institution oversees that? Is that the police department? Is that the state's attorney's office? Where would that sit?
Right, right. I believe this is through like the state's human services department.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a state level piece, not the local front.
So it's like the Department of Health and Human Services in Baltimore.
Right.
And for the state of Maryland.
State of Maryland.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha. I want to go to the phone lines because folks are checking in to share their thoughts on this conversation. Also, we got a couple of people on Facebook that share their thoughts. Rob said, let me start off by saying I'm in full support of gunshot victims getting something in return for their suffering. But why call it reparations when you know they're going to twist and mingle this up with reparations for slavery? This just seems like an attempt to confuse the two. Who are these people really working for? Sanjito or Ernest, any one of you want to kind of speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, because, I mean, it's still a form of reparations. I mean, I understand the semantics of it, you know, reparations, you know, historically has been regarding for slavery and the 40 acres and the mule, et cetera. And even in the current climate of this Democratic primary going on, but it's still a form of reparation. We can't leave, you know, create a new word for what it is. I mean, reparations is what it is. And no, we're not, you know, working for for the opposite side or any other side. We're just putting the facts on the table.
Yeah.
And bringing the information to light for the people.
All right. Let's go to the phone lines. 410-319-8888. Donna, check it in. Donna, what's your take on this?
Hey, this is Donna from yesterday. How you doing? Sorry you got me calling back once again. As a person, I literally had one of my cab customers. I refused to pick him up because he's wearing, you know, Nazi tattoos and Hitler tattoos. So, of course, not picking this man up. He came to my house with a knife. Beer in one hand, knife in the other, sliced my husband, tried to cut his throat. And I have pictures if you ever want to see them, but sliced my husband, sliced my son-in-law. This was all in front of my grandchildren on my birthday.
Oh, my goodness.
So when the police get there, I had to call them several times. When they get there, they send this one police officer who looked like he's 12 years old. He's terrified. He don't know what's going on. I had to jump in front of my husband because he's got his hand on the gun, the hand on the mace. I said, you really want to shoot grandma on her birthday here? So that was the first problem. The second thing was once this Rambo police officer came and settled things down, tried to set me on the curb. That didn't go over too well. I refused. But once we got to the hospital and they realized what was going on, there was a group of people who came in and said they were with the victims advocates group and all this stuff. But let me tell you, here's the problem. They came in at the time. I couldn't think straight. We're stitching up my husband.
Right.
22 stitches. 42 stitches, 22 staples. It was a mess. And my son-in-law, that's a whole other story. His artery was bleeding. And everyone's hysterical.
Mm.
But then when I tried to get a hold of these people, it became very difficult for me because I'm like, you know, I don't feel right. I keep thinking, what if? What if he would have cut my husband's throat? What if my son-in-law would have died? What if we all died and my grandchildren were next on the list? It was a mess. So that's the first problem, is getting them. Then the second thing is not everyone, like you said, has your birth certificate. Not everyone has your Social Security card, and you cannot get past the red tape. And guess what? A lot of these homeless people are victims of gunshots, of violence. You see them in wheelchairs. A lot of those folks have been shot.
Mm.
They don't have access to this stuff. We need to go out on the street once again and talk to these people and get them help. They cannot go sit all day long at the Vital Records to get their birth certificate and pay $25 for it.
Right.
Social Security card's free, but that's an all-day event going there. And they don't have the mentality to sit there. And then a lot of these people you see, if you talk to them, the homeless people, everybody has a story.
Absolutely. Hey, you know what, Donna? First and foremost, my heart is and prayers go out to you and your family. For enduring such a, wow, I'm just blown away. But I truly appreciate you for sharing that because I think it speaks volumes about you and your family, but also speaks volumes about the system that we're a part of. And Sanhita, I want to bring this back to you. When we're looking at violence, victims of violence, you know, is this call just for gunshots, or can it cover a situation, a circumstance that Donna just described with her family?
So the Crime Victim Compensation Fund, they cover all victims of crime. So
okay.
they would definitely cover that case.
Sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it sounds like, you know, even if they cover the case, just the fact of, you know, you, again, going back through all of this, you went through a horrific experience, but then you got to go through the jargon, the red tape, all of that, the paperwork of just trying to get some level of coverage.
Oh, absolutely. I should clarify that. When I said it would cover it, I meant technically only.
We've
documented in this report, and as she just shared so powerfully,
there
are a range of challenges that people have to face before they're able to get the help that they should be getting much more easily from these type of programs. So I think the coverage, if at all, very often may just be on paper. In practice, there is a long and very difficult road that needs to be walked before you get there. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Man, that's horrific. That's absolutely just devastating. Again, Donna, my heart and prayers go out to you and your family for your recovery from that circumstance. Let's go to Thomas. Thomas, checking in. What's your take on this, Thomas?
Hey, brother Muhammad. Good evening to everyone on board. I had a question regarding my situation. In 1989, I was coming to a neighborhood of a musician, robbery attempt. I got shot in my lower back. I have been dealing ongoing with medical issues. I have IBS now, nerves, and I have issues now where I just very conscientious and with the public. The city did take care of most of the hospital bill, but I have not been able to hold a job up. I was not a whole truck driver, not able to do that any longer, not able to sit and stand for long periods of time. I'm just now hearing about this victim compensation board. I didn't even know anything about this existence. So according to what you are sharing, and I pose this question for you with the MSD International, with the surgery alone, being cut from my upper chest all the way down to my groin, and the staples at the time weren't those dissolving staples. They were the metal staples.
Right.
So would I, mind you, 89, 90, I don't know if there is a period of...
A statute of limitations?
Do I, based on the information at hand, would I be included and being able to get assistance and compensation?
That's a great question. And Thomas, that's a great question. And again, our hearts and prayers go out to you for your circumstance, brother. But that's a great question. Sanhita or Ernest, does anyone of you know if there is a statute of limitation when it comes to that?
It's really the state by state. I don't know exactly for Maryland if it is. So, yeah, I think it is a statute. Go ahead, Sanhita.
So there is a time limit usually within which you need to be able to file the victim compensation claim from mm-hmm. when the crime occurred.
How much time does a victim have?
So in Maryland, I'm just pulling up the statistics, uh-huh. but in Maryland, you have to apply within 3 years of the date of incident.
3 years.
I think there are so many nuances in all the cases. So yeah. I would just think that I would really advise that they either get in touch with the victim advocates, or if they're interested in speaking with us in more detail later, we'd be happy to do that as well. But I think it would be really good to think about that case more closely because, depending on the nuances, there may be things that we don't know about and we haven't considered that could actually help with approaching the board.
Right. I would agree with that. You know what, Sanhita? I'm the type of guy, it's hard for me to take no for an answer. So when it is, Ernest, I'm serious. I cannot take no for an answer. So when I'm going up against institutions, when I'm trying to deal with legal issues, when I'm trying to deal with things, healthcare issues, I don't want to hear, well, no, sir, it's not possible. Don't tell me it's not possible. It is possible. That gets under my skin like to no end. So when I hear that, you don't apply, you mean to tell me in 2019, you can't, like, we are so set in policy, right, that it does not evolve with the times and certainly with the needs of the people. And I think that's one of the issues why so many institutions that serve the whether you're talking about human services, human development, in so many institutions that serve us in our society are just failing because they have yet to evolve. They're so stuck on policy and not actually looking at the reality of things that are happening in people's lives. And so principally, I understand. I'm not saying that we should just run amok. There should be some guidelines. There should be some consideration. But at the end of the day, if you're human services, if you're supposed to be for victims and you're supposed to be helping those who can't speak out for themselves, then there needs to be some level of compassion in your service. That's it. So that's the big thing. Ernest?
Yeah, no, totally agree. I think that's the challenge with these victim compensation funds is that not only from the story that the sister gave earlier, I mean, we have some same type of stories from research and interviews with survivors that way, but is that, it hasn't evolved, it hasn't changed, and people don't, and then you have states and communities that don't even know that the fund is out there.
Right, which is why we wanted to have this conversation.
Right, yeah, they don't even know it's there to even petition to try to get some help or some compensation back for being off work for a time, or, mom or dad or family member is off work to help you, you know, after this crime or this, you know, this gunshot has taken place. And quickly as well, we released our original gun violence report last year in August, end of August, first of September. It's called In the Line of Fire. And it totally goes over gun violence in totality, from, you know, every day that we deal with in the Chicago and the Baltimore, to domestic violence, to suicide. Even a piece on it was police use of force.
Mm-hmm.
And so this report here is kind of like a part two, where we delve into now the survivor piece as well. And then later on in the fall, we'll be coming out with more like a part three as well that really talks about some domestic violence issues as well.
That's fantastic.
So, I mean, it's the gun violence, as you know, the gun violence, you know, issue is huge and multifaceted and deeply layered as well. So it's just our part as Amnesty of doing what we do most definitely in research, and really bringing this to light and hopefully engaging the community to help come with, you know, them helping us and us helping them come with solutions and how we can galvanize the community to really make change, some substantive changes on the ground.
Absolutely. Cozy, talk to me. What's your take on it, sir? Checking in from Baltimore.
Hey, how you doing, Faraj?
I'm good, Cozy. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing okay. I'm doing okay today, you know, man. I think I want to make sure that I got this right because I quite like the tail here. So they're saying that, okay, if Paul shoots Bob, say Paul's a criminal, Bob's a criminal, Paul shoots Bob, and Bob lives, so he can get compensation because he lives.
If he's
a criminal.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't look at what your status is. It just looks about making sure that you're able to recover properly.
Okay, all right. And then the name was reparations. Yeah, I understand that, but that's a little confusing. Why not just call it something else like gunfire amnesty or Rosewood recovery or compensation corps, something like that? You know, it's just, I don't know. I just don't like the reparations thing mixed in with that. And I understand what it's for, but
yeah,
I don't know. If that's the case, then call it the Holocaust homies or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That part I don't like.
The part
anyway,
you don't like.
Keep up the good work.
Hey, I appreciate that, Cozy. Thank you so much. Let's go back to the phone lines. We're going to get Kevin. You got the final word as we talk to Ernest and Sanhita. Kevin?
Yes. Now, I have had to use the Victims' Rights Fund back in 2015. Both my sister and my nephew were murdered.
Mm.
So that's two funerals. She had no insurance. Our parents had passed away. So the older brother, I'm left to pay for two funerals, and I have six children of my own.
My goodness.
I was blessed to, at the funeral home, they informed me about the Victims' Rights Fund. I had a couple family members that mentioned it, but nobody really knew how to go about it. And the funeral home directed me to actually they called Colonel Russell.
Melvin Russell.
Yes. He sent someone to Wiley's funeral home to meet with us and explained everything, and they took a huge burden off of my shoulders to be able to know that you have to bury a loved one from street violence and know that that's one thing that you don't have to worry about. How am I going to pay for this? How am I going to put my family member away? So my experience with the city and the Victims' Rights Fund has been great. Even afterwards, I got letters. They had counseling, all kinds of services. I still get letters now. Every year I still get letters now inviting me back for therapy and saying, hey, you know, it's still available for you. So my experience was good with it. Now, as far as everybody not knowing about it, I don't know if that really should be too public. You know about it when you need it. So maybe a victim's right person from the city or the police department, when something happens, should be in each hospital or something like that.
Right.
But if it's too publicized, I mean, let's
may not have enough money.
People. Exactly.
May not have. Hey, Kevin, I appreciate you for checking in and sharing that. And certainly our condolences to your family, brother. But I'm glad that you were able to share that side of it. Sanhita, Ernest, thank you so much. I know that, again, you're going to be at Morgan State tomorrow here and on the campus of Morgan State University at the Student Center. You're going to be in the room, room 211, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Is that correct, Ernest?
Yes.
All right. Yes, and this is open, free and open to the public to learn more about this this issue and this process, right?
Yes. Well, more the issue, and then we'll be talking about some remedies and how to fix it. I mean, we're not experts, and we're not advancing or giving out information on the particular fund here in the state.
Yes.
We're just talking about the issue itself, right?
Sanhita, how can people get a copy of this new report that is coming out from Amnesty International, Scars of Survival, Gun Violence and Barriers to Reparation in the USA?
So it's definitely going to be available online tomorrow, and we're also going to be carrying a lot of copies at the event tomorrow. So those are two really good ways to get access to it.
That sounds great. Sanhita Ambest, Ernest Culverson, thank you so much for checking in and being and having this conversation with us here on For the Culture here on WEAA.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. All right, folks, that's going to do it for us as well. If you want to get more information, make sure you check out Amnesty International. But more importantly, check out what they have to say. Come through to Morgan State University to the Student Center, room 211, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. to learn more about this issue and how you can be a part of the solution to advocate for victims of gun violence. That's going to do it for me. I want to thank my dynamic production team, as Mallory Pinker-Pierre, Alex Blanc, my engineers, Sean Don and Dre Day, and my assistant producer, Amrita. And I want to thank each and every one of you for being a part of the conversation, both online and on air. Continue to show your support and love by checking out WEAA.org. You can download all of your latest episodes of your favorite episodes of For the Culture, as well as Today with Dr. K. And you can get your take on all of the latest news and information, things that are happening around the city. That all can be found at WEAA.org. Stay tuned. Up next is In the Groove with my big sister, LaDawn Black, giving you that cool jazz, that neo-soul, and that smooth R&B for your evening hours. So stick around for LaDawn with that. As always, never be afraid to challenge what's wrong. Stand for what's right while being yourself in the process. I look forward to talking to you tomorrow for another exciting edition of For the Culture right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM and WEAA.org. Absolutely the voice of the community. Remember, Baltimore, do more, but be exceptionally good for the culture. Peace.